Hello there, and welcome back to yet another episode of Cooper Talks. I don't know why I always sound surprised that it's another episode, because of course it's another episode. But yes, I'm here, and today, carrying on the Cold War series of podcasts, I am going to look at the Cuban Missile Crisis, which, if you like, was one of the peaks or troughs, depending on your point of view, of international relations during the Cold War era, and probably... people like to claim, though there's probably quite a good degree of truth here, that this was the closest the world came during the Cold War to an actual nuclear war. So let's do a little recap on the context of Cuba and what was going on. This is all occurring in October 1962. So if you listen to my most recent podcast, the ones on the Bay of Pigs and Cuban background, you'll understand that why Cuba was strategically so important just off the coast of Florida. Also, you'd had the failure of the Bay of Pigs invasion and the whole fiasco that embarrassed Kennedy, and then you had the follow-up with the Berlin Wall and the ultimatum and the standoff between communist forces and capitalist forces in Berlin, which again had weakened Kennedy and made Khrushchev look stronger. So we get to a year later and it's 1962. Now, what's been happening in the interim? First thing to remember is the nature of the arms race that had been going on. So obviously since World War II, since the development of the first nuclear weapons, both sides have been building up their missiles, building up their nuclear technology, developing the atom bomb, the nuclear fusion bomb, hydrogen bomb as it's sometimes called, and developing nuclear weapons that were more and more powerful, but also increasing missile technology. Remember, the earliest nuclear weapons could only be delivered by planes, and planes, of course, can be quite easily shot down and are quite vulnerable. And they'd use rocketry to develop missile technology. And by the 1960s, they had intermediate range missiles as well as short-range missiles. They hadn't yet managed to develop the intercontinental ballistic missiles that could travel right the way around the globe. Now, there was a lot of talk about a missile gap, and the Americans were basically winning on this one. They sometimes claim they weren't, but they were winning in terms of nuclear warheads. So you've got the missile, if you like, is the casing, the rocket, and the nuclear warhead is the explosive bit that goes at the top and will blow up and cause all the damage. And I think the Russians did have slightly more missiles, but the Americans had more nuclear warheads and more powerful ones at this stage. Here's the thing, though. The nature of the rockets, as well as the planes, meant that although there was this mad theory, mutually assured destruction, that kept a sort of balance of peace because both sides were scared of the other one destroying them, actually, the balance was very much in favour of America, because if you look at where the short-range and intermediate-range missiles could be based, America, thanks to its NATO allies in Europe, including Turkey, and Turkey's important. Remember, Turkey actually bordered the Soviet Union. What is current-day Armenia and Azerbaijan were part of the Soviet Union. Of course, it's just south of the Black Sea. So America had various nuclear weapons and bases in places like Britain, Germany. Well, not in West Germany, but in France and in Turkey. And that meant that their missiles could cover most of Russia, particularly the European part of Russia. It meant Moscow could be reached, as well as Leningrad, which is modern-day St. Petersburg and old-day St. Petersburg. But the city of Leningrad, as well as strategic bases like Kyiv, Minsk, Odessa, key Black Sea ports in Crimea, the vast Sevastopol, Stalingrad, and other major industrial cities. So the Americans had the potential to launch nuclear missiles and hit most American most Soviet territory. The Soviets, on the other hand, even if they placed their nuclear weapons at the furthest extreme, kind of around Vladivostok all the way along the Pacific coast, they could hit Alaska and Hawaii, which is part of the reason why those two territories were made into states in 1959. See, all this goes on at the moment. So they're actually made states rather than territories. But they could also really only hit kind of Seattle. Obviously, bad news for Seattle, but that northwestern corner of the United States around the state of Washington, that was about it. Most of mainland America wasn't under threat. Now, of course, in Europe, with the NATO allies, pretty much all of them were under threat of nuclear attack from the Soviet Union. So it wasn't as if America and her allies had no threat, but America itself was relatively free. Okay, the only way nuclear weapons could be delivered would be via planes. Cuba, becoming communist in the early 1960s, which we've talked about in the background in the Bay of Pigs, and becoming increasingly closely allied with the Soviet Union, changes the dynamics a lot. Because if nuclear weapons and nuclear missiles were placed in Cuba, then the Soviet Union would have a military base that could launch nuclear attacks on most American cities, particularly across the eastern seaboard. They'd obviously get to Washington, could just about get to New York City, the industrial part of America in the Midwest, as well as Texas and so on. So it would make most of America vulnerable to the short range and intermediate range nuclear weapons. Okay, now you can look at it one of two ways. Obviously, that makes the fear of there being nuclear weapons based in Cuba a real concern to the Americans and something they just won't be able to tolerate. On the other side, you could say, well, isn't that just asserting the balance of power? Because with American nuclear weapons in Turkey as well as other parts of Europe, Soviet Union is under greater threat than the USA is, and so placing nuclear missiles there, in a sense, balances it out, and surely America should just put up with that. These are some of the debates around the issue. Now, following on from the Bay of Pigs incident, in order to protect Cuba and Castro as now a communist state, the Soviet Union not only plowed in resources, but they also built up a huge military presence in Cuba using conventional military. So they plowed tanks and armaments, weapons, as well as military training and equipment at all levels for the Cuban military. And Cuba basically became probably the best armed Latin American, certainly Central American, if not across all the Americas after the USA and Canada, best and the most military equipped country. And the USA seemed to be okay and accept that, and it kind of goes back to the whole Truman Doctrine. Cuba had been lost, it had gone communist, okay, not great, but they would accept that. And the conventional weapons were seen as more defensive. Cuba is, of course, an island. It's very difficult, as the Americans found out in the Bay of Pigs, to launch a sea-based offensive, and so they were kind of content with there being Soviet build-up of conventional weapons in Cuba. Even some degree missile technology, though they were less happy about that, because missiles were seen at, actually they weren't happy about the missile technology at all. They didn't want missile technology being there because that's more of an offensive weapon rather than a defensive weapon. Okay, so the build-up of conventional forces via the Soviet Union in Cuba was seen as defensive. Rockets, missiles would be seen as offensive. Now, what we end up with in October 1962 is the USA is using U-2 spy planes, much like the one that had been shot down over Russia in 1959, but they've been using them to spy on Cuba and keep an eye on what was going. And in October 1962, I think September's 1962, a U-2 spy plane flying over Cuba had taken photographs identifying that there were currently missile silos and locations, missile launch pads effectively, being constructed and based in Cuba, and that these were clearly being built by the Soviet Union. Now, American intelligence and experts doing things that I wouldn't be able to understand, but they were looking at these photographs, and not only did they identify that they were building these advanced these advanced missile bases, but they were clearly preparing for nuclear armaments, and that some of them were nearly ready. So, having taken these aerial shots, they were able to identify the construction of missiles as an offensive weapon, and also that these were likely to be nuclear weapons. And I just want you to kind of think about that, because obviously the Soviet Union knew that there were going to be U-2 spy planes, because they were all spying on each other and they had the proof that they'd been spying on the Soviet Union. If they'd been spying on the Soviet Union, they were definitely going to be spying on Cuba. So what's surprising is that there was no attempt to hide this. There was no camouflage, there was no sort of masking it. These missile silos were just being built quite openly. It was almost a provocation here, and kind of links back to that whole idea of Kennedy being pushed by Khrushchev. Khrushchev kind of trying to push him and see how far he could go and what he would do. It was almost blatant. There was also news that a number of transport ships, about 20 of them, 20 or 12, can't remember, but a number of these ships had left the Soviet Union, were heading for Cuba, and it was believed these would contain actual missiles, and there was the potential they could also include nuclear warheads. Now, again, completely surprising, there was no camouflage. The missiles were actually on deck. They weren't stowed away in the cargo hold. I mean, they were quite big, obviously, but, you know, there was no attempt to disguise this or hide these missiles. So again, the Soviet Union, Khrushchev would have known that the Americans would be spying on this and monitoring this, so it seems like it was deliberately a sense of provocation. And we'll come to the whys of that in a bit. Now, President Kennedy is informed of this. And so, if you like, this is the third time in the space of 3 years that Kennedy is being pushed by Khrushchev to a degree. I mean, Bay of Pigs wasn't really Khrushchev, but you have the Bay of Pigs, you have then the Cuban Missile Crisis, you have the Berlin Wall being constructed, and now you've got this. But this is different, because this is in America's backyard. It's in that territory of Cuba that they've seen as their own, and it's a direct threat to the American mainland, potentially. And Kennedy meets with his advisors. He forms a subcommittee called XCOM, which is basically dominated by him and his brother. And some people want to go on a preemptive strike. They want to kind of attack Cuba, declare them. Others want to bomb the missile bases, some to attack the ships directly, some to do nothing and say, hey, we've got Turkey, you've got Cuba, all's fair. Kennedy knew he couldn't sit back and do nothing, because, again, that would just destroy him. And it is worth bearing in mind, in America, they have congressional elections every 2 years. And 1962, in November, there were a series of congressional elections coming up that Kennedy wanted the Democrats to do well in. And having already appeared weak on communism in the Bay of Pigs and Berlin Wall being built, he knew that a third one would just be catastrophic for their chances of keeping control, certainly of the Senate, possibly the House as well, due to the way American politics worked at the time, and also to his own chances of winning re-election in 1964. So he knew he couldn't do nothing, but he also recognised that if nuclear weapons were actually placed there, that would be a huge threat to America. And if he took some sort of decisive military action, actually bomb sites, it would effectively be declaration of war and could lead to a full-scale nuclear war. So this is a very tense moment in October of 1962. So much so, Kennedy actually does make ready a series of ballistic missiles and bombers made ready to attack Cuba as well as in NATO allies. And it was 18 Soviet ships had set sail on the way. So a really tense moment. Kennedy basically gets on a war footing. And what he decides to do is he unilaterally, and again that's important, unilaterally, not by consulting his NATO allies, he unilaterally imposes a 500-mile, that's about 850-kilometre blockade around the island of Cuba. And he makes a public declaration internationally as well as to the American people, and he says, okay, we've identified this threat of nuclear war, of these missiles heading there, we've imposed this blockade. If any ships break that blockade, then we will view that as a declaration of war, and we will use any and all measures to basically deal with it. So it was a clear threat of war, that if the Soviet Union's ships carried on and breached this blockade that the Americans had imposed around, it would be an act of war, and they would retaliate. So this was a really tense moment because, of course, having drawn that line in the sand, or in the water in this case, jokes, but in this case, having put the marker down, the question is going to be, well, what's going to happen next? Is Khrushchev going to blink? It's kind of like a giant game of chicken. Both, you know, both combatants are heading towards each other. Who's going to blink first? Who's going to move? Neither actually wants nuclear war, but the other doesn't know what's happening. If Kennedy, if Khrushchev calls his bluff and sails the missiles to Cuba and Kennedy does nothing, then Kennedy's presidency is over. Effectively, he's done. And America is crippled at this stage of the Cold War. If, on the other hand, Kennedy retaliates and actually does stand up to the blockade, and then, if it's breached, launch an attack, then you have a nuclear war. Khrushchev, who's feeling more confident after the Bay of Pigs and Berlin Wall and feels that Kennedy's quite weak, Khrushchev feels that he could probably get away with breaching the blockade and Kennedy would do nothing. But of course, if he risks that, he does risk an all-out war, which the Soviet Union's not yet ready for. Plus, if he turns the ships around, again, that could be seen as damaging for him. Although, he's potentially viewing it as a way to get some concessions out of the Americans. And actually, that's suggested by a letter that he wrote to Kennedy. Okay, now it's an interesting one because, having denied that there were nuclear missiles in Cuba and that the Soviet Union had no intention of putting missiles or nuclear weapons there, Khrushchev then sends a letter basically admitting that there are missile bases there and that's their plans, but saying that he would be willing to withdraw the missile bases and to destroy the missile bases that they'd already built and to turn the ships around and do that, as long as the USA promised to recognize Cuba as communist and to promise to allow it to remain an independent state and not to threaten invasion or attack again. So in a sense, he's trying to get a concession about Cuba. The second letter, well, that's the first letter that comes through. A few days later, there's a second letter, which does kind of suggest Khrushchev didn't have that much of a plan, because the second letter goes, oh, yes, by the way, also, we'll only destroy the missiles if you promise to withdraw the nuclear missiles from Turkey and apologise for the U-2 spy plane being shot down in 1959. Yes, that's it. So they send the second letter. So Kennedy's now got decisions to make. And what Kennedy does, he's kind of happy enough with the first one. The first letter... Okay, it sort of could be seen as a humiliation, but ultimately it's just saying, okay, well, we'll stop trying to kill Castro officially and making Cuba, you know, we won't, because we've got no plans to do a Bay of Pigs issue again after that failure. So we'll just tolerate Cuba being a communist state in the American hemisphere. As long as there's no nuclear weapons there, we'll learn to live with it. Okay, it's not great, but they could probably live with that one. The second letter, the demand to remove the nuclear missiles from Turkey and apology, kind of thing, I can't do that. If I do that, I'm going to be crippled and weakened again. So his brother, Robert Kennedy, who was part of XCOM and his attorney general, he says, well, why don't you just pretend you never got the second letter? And we'll just say we got the first letter and we agree to those terms. Which is such a very simple thing and such, you know, I'm sure people have done that before. Yeah, no, we got that second message. Anyway, that's what they do. And so Kennedy publicly says, okay, that's fine. We will accept that. Khrushchev, don't you worry. We will accept Cuba as communist and we won't do any dealings. We won't do anything to stop that. And we'll respect them and respect your conventional forces being there, just not nuclear weapons. And the missiles, ships, the Soviet ships on the way stopped just short of the blockade and they turned around and they went sailing home. So that was it. Okay, the crisis I mean, it's called the Cuban Missile Crisis, but I suppose it was the almost crisis. So it came close, but in the end, the Soviet ships turned around and the missiles were sent back to the Soviet Union, and the actual crisis was averted. But it was close. So it's kind of like a sea-based version of the tanks squaring off at Checkpoint Charlie. Now, that in a nutshell was the Cuban Missile Crisis. What were the results of this then? What were the consequences? Well, for Kennedy, it boosts his reputation quite considerably, because the way it's presented in the American media and the way it comes across internationally is that he stood up to Khrushchev, and Khrushchev was the one who blinked, because Kennedy had imposed this blockade. He stood up to Khrushchev, and then the ships had turned around and gone back home. So he's seen as a hero as a result of this. It wasn't all good for Kennedy. There were still some people criticising him for allowing Cuba to become a fully-fledged communist state and promising to defend it, kind of seen as an ultimate failure of the Truman Doctrine then, in a sense, and containment, and also people not happy about the threat imposed there, particularly a lot of the Cuban exiles and the more hawkish in the Republican Party at that time. They saw it as a mistake. There was also a lot of discontent in NATO countries who felt that Kennedy and America had been acting unilaterally, hadn't consulted their NATO allies, making the point, yeah, you guys weren't the ones under threat of being attacked by Russian or Soviet nuclear weapons. We were, and you didn't even bother talking to us about it. That actually led to France resigning from the military aspects of NATO, saying, nope, we're not going to have any more of that. So it did damage NATO alliances to a degree. Also, because another consequence that comes out of this is that following the Cuban Missile Crisis, Kennedy did agree in secret with Khrushchev that as long as it was kept secret, he would remove the nuclear weapons from Turkey. So in a sense, Khrushchev does get what he wanted in the second letter. But because it's after the events of the crisis, and because Kennedy says, I'm only going to do it if it's secret, if anything becomes public about this, I'm putting them back in there, Khrushchev can't say anything about it. And of course, with the removal of these nuclear weapons from Turkey, without consulting other NATO allies, people felt a bit cheated, and that they were kind of just being used as pawns by America, and that they weren't an equal part. So it does cause some division within NATO. Overall, though, it is good for Kennedy. For Khrushchev, though, he thinks it's a great victory because he's managed to get concessions from America saying, yes, we will respect Cuban sovereignty, we'll respect them being communist, we'll allow there to be build-up of nuclear weapons and all of that, and we promise we won't invade or attack or support any attempts to do so. So from his point of view, it looks like he's gained something from this, and could be that was his whole plan all along, that he just wanted to push the Americans or goad them into making these concessions, and it worked. Eventually, he also got what he wanted with the nuclear weapons being removed from Turkey. So he thinks, in 1962, that he's done really well. He's been an effective statesman. However, the reality of it was really damaging for Khrushchev. Partly, he's seen as the one that blinked. Okay, having authorised the building of the having authorised the building of the Berlin Wall and stood up to Kennedy there, it looks like he's sort of pushed Kennedy, but this time he's blinked and turned round. And this was almost a more important message. Had they got the nuclear missiles in Cuba, then it would have redressed the missile gap and showed the Soviet Union to kind of be on an equal footing with America, or at least equally enough to make MAD an effective doctrine. The big concession, the removal of nuclear weapons from Turkey, well, that was unofficial, and Khrushchev couldn't make that public to anyone, otherwise the missiles would be put back in Turkey. So the big achievement he had to keep secret, he wasn't able to declare it. So he does feel he's won, but most of what he's gained doesn't seem that much to a lot of the higher-ups in the Soviet Union. There's also a sense of humiliation, having had to be the ones to back down here. And that's very much the way it appeared globally, that the Soviet Union had backed down after a minor concession from America, but not much of one. The Americans also insisted that all the missiles be kept on the decks of the 18 Soviet ships when they were returning so that they could count them. And again, that's kind of a humiliation that we're saying, right, we're going to be watching you and keeping an eye on you. And so they feel there's been a humiliation for the Soviet military and they've been made to look weak as a result. So for all these reasons, Khrushchev is actually weakened and he loses the backing of a lot of the senior figures in the Soviet Union and will actually be removed from power in 1964 and live off in retirement. But that's a key thing. Khrushchev actually, not directly, because it's a couple of years later, but this probably sets in motion a chain of events that will lead to Khrushchev losing support and being removed. It also doesn't help him that the other big communist force at the time was China, led by Mao Zedong. Now, Mao and Khrushchev had already had tensions over who was the real leader of worldwide communism and so on. And Mao basically comes out and he says, no, you just look weak and pathetic. That's terrible that you didn't put the nuclear missiles there. And this criticism from Mao really stings Khrushchev and it stings the whole of the Soviet Union. It kind of suggests that Mao is the one that all future communist states should look to. Mao and China are the ones that will protect them. The Soviet Union can't be relied on to protect their allies. So that's also damaging. But it does lead to a division between the two major communist powers, which will then be exploited in the 1960s and 70s, particularly in the 1970s under Richard Nixon, to create more peaceful relations between the major powers, a thing called détente, which I'll look at in the future. The other thing that comes out, well, I mean, I'll talk very briefly about it now, but because the Cuban Missile Crisis was about as close as they reckoned the world came to an actual nuclear war, both sides were kind of horrified by this. So it led to both sides saying, okay, let's sort this out so we don't come this ridiculously close to war in the future. First thing they agree is a 1965 treaty, a nuclear non-proliferation treaty. Now, it wasn't much, sorry, it's not, yeah, non-proliferation treaty or arms limitation talks. Sorry, none of that's true. Ugh, losing my train of thought. What they agreed to was a partial test ban treaty. Now, that wouldn't limit them developing more powerful weapons, but it was the first time they agreed to at least restrict the amount of testing they were doing and kind of hold back a bit on the arms race. So it was the first time some brakes had been applied to slow the arms race. It was still going forward, it was still progressing, but at a slower rate. This would then lead to the development of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, where they'd agree not to share nuclear weapons and technology with other countries. And it would then pave the way for the Strategic Arms Limitation Talks, or SALT, and détente, peaceful relations, or better relations going forward. They also said, you know what, we were so close to nuclear war over these 13 days, maybe writing letters is not the best way to go about it. So this led to the introduction of a hotline between the White House and the Kremlin, where they could basically go straight through and actually talk to each other directly. The USA also agreed to start up grain supplies to the Soviet Union, again supplying them with grain to feed the people and alleviate some of the hunger that was going on there. And of course, the nuclear missiles withdrawn as well. So in terms of the Cold War, the Cuban Missile Crisis being such a high point of tension then leads to a period of more peaceful coexistence between the two major sides. So that's effectively the series of events that happened around the Cuban Missile Crisis. Now, obviously, within a couple of years, things changed dramatically. Kennedy is assassinated in 1963 in Dallas by Lee Harvey Oswald. I know there's a lot of conspiracy theories about that, but just go with it at this time. And Khrushchev is removed from power in 1964. So you will have a change of leadership on both sides within a year of each other. You'll also end up with a couple of major events going on, particularly the Vietnam War, which develops in the 1960s, as well as the civil rights movement in America and the Prague Spring 1968. So there's going to be tensions that are going to kind of play out as part of the Cold War, but also distract from the main hostility between the two. And of course, relations between the Soviet Union and China will also change the dynamic of things going on. So Cuba, if you like, the Cuban Missile Crisis is a high point of tensions. Depending on how you phrase it, when the Cold War was closest to becoming a hot war, or when it was at its coldest, the analogies we use here and metaphors are quite mixed. Okay, the Cold War getting hotter and colder. What does it mean? But these were the big consequences. As for Cuba, well, it would carry on. CIA would still try illegal assassination attempts on Castro, but it was secure and safe. It would become a sort of basis to launch communist attempts on other Latin American countries, particularly Bolivia. Che Guevara was eventually found there. Other states, so kind of begin a series of proxy wars in Latin America. It would continue to get vast amounts of subsidies and aid and military funding from the Soviet Union as long as the Soviet Union existed. But it also had huge amounts of sanctions imposed on it by America that are still in place, mostly. And what was the other one? Oh, yes. And basically, the nationalization of the American businesses and industry in Cuba was effectively recognized, by Kennedy's acceptance not to attack them. So there you go. That's kind of the results of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Probably more important for what didn't happen rather than what did happen, but the consequences for the path of the Cold War were huge, and we will look at some of those next time. In the next event, what should I do next? I think a few podcasts ago I said that it was a series that would three major crises which would get to the Prague Spring in 1968, but before I do that, I'm actually going to do one thing on the Vietnam War, because I think understanding the context of the Vietnam War, which goes on throughout this period, will give a greater depth of understanding when I talk about the Prague Spring. I don't know, I might change my mind on that one. Anyway, by the time you're listening to this, you may have heard me, I may have done both recordings, and you can listen to them in whatever order you would like to. So thank you very much for listening. I hope it's been of use, and I will speak to you again in the future. Bye.